Well, go ahead and grab your Bibles, if you have them, and turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. That's the book of Ecclesiastes, and we'll be in chapter 4 this morning. And while you're finding your place, let me just go ahead and say, just kind of by way of reminder, that since the beginning of this book, Solomon has been brutally honest about the nature of this life. He's shown us that you and I live in a world of what he's labeled as Havel, that is, we live in an existence that's broken and twisted and really even just upside down. And so there's just this theme to life that makes it hard. And what we've seen is that you don't have to be a Christian or really even know what's in the Bible to know that this is an accurate description of life, that there's something not only twisted in this world, but also something broken and fractured even right within your own soul. And so just in case we might doubt this, Solomon has showed us that you and I live a life characterized by a constant pursuit of something. We want success, we want meaning, we want happiness. But Solomon says that what makes this pursuit havel is that it's like chasing after the wind, where even if you knew where it was coming from or where it was going, he wonders, what would you catch it with? And not only that, but he's shown us that while we're so desperately chasing after something so that we might find ultimate satisfaction, or to use his term, gain, the sad thing about this pursuit is we don't even know what we're looking for. Like, even if we did happen to stumble upon the thing that would finally fill the void in our souls, that would give ultimate meaning and purpose and satisfaction, Solomon says, we wouldn't even recognize it. And the reason for that is because, as he showed us in chapter 2, each person in this world possesses a heart that's had eternity placed on it. That is, we have an eternal void that longs to be filled. We were created to be satisfied in something eternal. But the problem is we live in the finite, and so everything we chase is finite and fleeting, which is why nothing ever satisfies. And so starting then at the end of chapter 2, Solomon showed us that we must look to something above the sun for an answer. Something above the sun that's infinite, which ultimately the Bible argues is God himself. And so now in chapter 3 and then coming into chapter 4, Solomon bringing God into the picture, wanting us to learn how to discover joy and contentment in a life that's still under the sun, that doesn't settle for easy answers, which is actually what I love so much about Solomon. He's a realistic sage or teacher of wisdom who refuses a kind of pie-in-the-sky theology where just because we now live life with reference to the Creator, that doesn't mean that the hardships and the struggles of life just somehow disappear. We still live under the sun. We still live in a broken, fractured universe. We still live a life that's completely characterized by this Hebrew idea of havel. And so entering now into chapter 4, he deals with some more issues of life. So let's go ahead and read it, and then we'll jump in. So chapter 4, starting in verse 4, and we'll, Lord willing, take it to the end of the chapter. Solomon writes, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is havel in striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. Then I looked again at all the vanity under the sun. And there was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is havel, and it is a grievous task. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even to the one who will come later, they will not be happy with him. For this too is havel in striving after the wind. Well, I said back in my very first sermon in this series that there will probably be some passages that, due to sort of the strange and even enigmatic structure with which Solomon tends to write, there might be passages in this book that won't lend themselves to smooth sermons. And so while I've tried to do the best job I could with where we've been so far, I think this one might be a bit choppy. And that's because he's actually dealing with three different issues in this text. In fact, many commentators and scholars have tried to find a common theme or thread that sort of holds this passage together. For example, some think that chapter 4 is a further commentary on the previous issues he's just dealt with, namely the issues of injustice and oppression. Some will say he's returning yet once again to the theme of labor. Others see the theme as broken community. That is, that these three issues in this text are simply the result of broken or rather twisted understandings of human relationships. And then others are simply content to say that there really is no true theme, and that Solomon here is really doing nothing more than just simply addressing a cluster of unrelated issues that have been characterized by havel. And so they view this section as really nothing more than just some proverbial sayings. And so whatever the theme, or perhaps even lack thereof, the point to understand is that there really is no true consensus on what the structure of this passage actually is. And the reason I want to draw your attention to this is because I think it's an important lesson on the nature of biblical wisdom and learning how to read the wisdom literature well. What's important to understand is that all Proverbs, and really the wisdom literature in general, is actually purposefully mysterious and difficult to understand, not only in its content, but also in its structure. One man puts it this way regarding Ecclesiastes. He said, "The kind of truth that Kohelet is teaching us is the kind of truth that comes through grappling with the hard things of life. It's the kind of teaching that only makes sense once you thought about it, rethought about it, and then rethought about it." In other words, the enigmatic style only forms an apparent barrier at the beginning, but soon the enigmatic style reveals that through hard work, it's part of the learning process. For without it, the truth simply would not apply as well. In other words, the discovery of biblical wisdom is hard work. The Proverbs, maxims, and really just the wisdom literature in general is purposefully difficult, and the reason for that is simple. Quite simply, the reason is so that the fool might not find it. Did you know that? It actually takes a certain degree of wisdom to find and then apply wisdom. This is one of the main reasons for why many Proverbs usually come in the form of short, ambiguous, and sometimes confusing statements. They're designed to conceal their truth from those who don't really desire it. For example, and this is one of the easier ones, and probably one everyone should prove fluency in before being allowed to have a Facebook account. But what do you do with Proverbs 26:4, where it says, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you become like him." And then in verse 5, the very next verse, he states, "Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes." Like, what do you do with that? How do you know when to apply these verses? And so the point is that it takes hard work and in most cases wisdom to know when and how to apply wisdom. Which is why he states just two verses later, "Like the legs which are useless to the lame, so is a proverb in the mouth of a fool." Over and over again we see fools can't handle the Proverbs. Which, by the way, is why foolish people are often lazy people. They're just not interested in doing the necessary work and then accurately applying the necessary wisdom. It takes hard work. So all of that to say, I found it, chapter 4 of Ecclesiastes, to be one of those hard texts. Really, the whole book of Ecclesiastes is one of those texts. But just fair warning that chapter 4 does seem to lend itself to this all the more. So with that, let's just go ahead and jump in here, starting in verse 4. And Solomon begins with a statement that quite simply is true of every person in this room. He writes, I have seen, so he begins here with an observation. He states, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. So the term rivalry here is actually a reference to envy. It's actually the word for jealousy. And so notice, he's not saying that your labor and your skill produces envy in somebody else, but actually the exact opposite. He's saying every labor and every skill that you do is done, that you do is the product of your jealousy. And so what he's saying here is that there is nothing which you or I do that is not at its core driven from envy. So the clothes that you wear, the car you drive, the house you live in, the way you decorate, the career you've chosen, all of it has been done, according to Solomon, not so much because you need to, but actually because you want your neighbor to see it. And so really all he's doing here is simply making an observation of our brokenness. He's saying that in the depths of our souls, the reason we do what we do or strive for what we strive for is because we want to be noticed. We want to stand out. We want to be on top. We want people to applaud what we've accomplished. But the problem is that the Havel goes both ways, doesn't it? Like the moment you reach the top, which, by the way, you're doing for the sake of praise, the return on your efforts from other people is not what you wanted from them, which is praise, but actually jealousy. And what's even more twisted is people more often than not do what they do not merely for the sake of praise, but so that they might actually move people to jealousy. And so unless there's something other than human in this room, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Now, the Bible calls this pride, and it's sin. But what's interesting here, and I want you to notice this, is that Solomon's goal, as it has been in the book so far, is to help give his readers a perspective so that they might navigate these issues of life well. And so notice what he says. Upon making this observation, he concludes here at the end of verse 4 that this too is havel in striving after the wind. And many commentators have actually chosen to translate the term havel here as absurdity. And I think they're exactly right. And the reason for that is because Solomon's point here in making this statement isn't so much to point out the sinfulness or the pride of our corrupt hearts, but actually to expose the absurdity of our sinful ways. So while Paul's approach in the New Testament might be to call this pride, Solomon calls it absurdity. And so what he's actually doing here is simply saying, look, people engage in this type of game for a lifetime. And the reason they do so is because they never actually come to a place where they're actually able to find contentment. Envy leads to envy. Strife leads to strife. But the result is that no one's any closer to any kind of happiness or lasting satisfaction. And so he says, we do what we do out of envy for the sake of other people's praise, but all it ever returns is their envy. And so we're just stuck on this hamster wheel, never actually finding contentment. And we all know what this is, right? We want to be happy when we hear of someone's promotion. We want to be happy when someone gets a new car, puts up pictures from their vacation. But the reality, and we know in our own hearts that more often than not, we're simply unable to rejoice with them from the fullness and purity of heart. Because there's just something about seeing someone else's success, indeed happiness, that digs up in you, as subtle as it may be, jealousy. It's actually one of the reasons for why the social media age is, I think, devastating to true, genuine relationships. Because most of the time, unless someone bears their emotions on their sleeves, the only status updates and pictures you see on Facebook and Instagram are the ones where everyone's having a good time, right? No one posts a picture of their bad days. No one Snapchats when they're in misery. No one uploads a video of their disobedient child being absolutely disrespectful. And so there's just this facade that's put on display. And the result is not only discouragement to those who are perhaps struggling with relationships or to parents who are constantly wrestling with their disobedient children, but all they ever see on Facebook are perfectly obedient kids, but it actually begins to produce up in them envy, strife, and jealousy. We all know there's competition among moms. We all know there's competition among men to work up the corporate ladder, not because they need to feed or clothe their family, but because they want prestige, power, and respect. We've all heard of the pastors who are burnt out and tired from trying to grow their church bigger than the guys down the street. And so all of this just speaks to the truth Solomon observed well over 2,000 years ago. That it's simply the way of mankind to do what they do from jealousy. We crave a bigger applause. So look at how he responds to this. And he's going to give us some wisdom here for how to get off the treadmill. He's going to give us some insight for how you can actually live your life and do your labor and exercise your skills in a manner that's not motivated from a heart that's craving praise. So verses 5 and 6. He states, "The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind." Now, what Solomon actually employs here are two proverbs, and they might be original to Solomon, or more likely, at least in the case of the first one, he's perhaps quoting, but nevertheless, it's one of the first times in Ecclesiastes that Solomon offers a form of traditional wisdom. And so his readers most likely would have been very familiar with these sort of proverbs. So the first one found in verse 5, which might sound familiar to some of you, is then qualified by the second in verse 6. So for those of you who like fancy terms, this is what is known as an antithetical parallel. That is, the two proverbs are stating the exact opposite thing. And the reason for that is so that the wisdom of the straight and wise path might seem all the more reasonable. Moreover, the first proverb here in verse 5 is written to those who might perhaps overreact to Solomon's point about labor resulting from jealousy, where they perhaps resolve then to just do nothing. And so the second proverb in verse 6 is a proverb of what is known as the golden means. It's the balanced approach, the right approach to the issue. So verse 5, Solomon states, "The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh." Now, we see in the Proverbs and really all throughout the Old Testament that the quintessential mark of a fool is the sluggard, that is, the lazy person. Now, this was in a day where a very well-known proverb was, "If you don't work, you don't eat." There simply was no such thing as welfare in Solomon's day, or the ability to stay in your parents' home until you're like 30. And so the fool was the one who folded his hands. You might remember from Proverbs 6, where Solomon there states, "A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a thief, and want like an armed man." And so the idea here of folding your hands is really just a picture of idleness. It's the description of the sluggard. And so this comment here on the lazy person consuming his own flesh is nothing more than a description then of the inevitable result of laziness. And the picture here is a graphic one. It's a picture displaying that when poverty comes, sort of due to your lack of work, you have nothing to eat, and so your body begins to deplete as it feeds on its reserves. Michael Fox, a Jewish commentator, sees the picture a bit differently. He states that the underlying picture in this verse is of a foolish man sitting with his hands clasped together and gnawing on his knuckles. It's an acrid or unpleasant scene of anxiety and self-destruction. So whatever the exact nuance of what this picture is supposed to be depicting, I think the meaning's clear enough. The essence of a fool is one who, despite the fact that their hunger is forcing them to consume their very own flesh, it's still not enough motivation to break them free from their bondage to laziness. And so let me just say that there are few things more aberrant to the world, but especially to God, than the lazy, foolish sluggard who leeches on society and expects everybody else to provide. Especially because before sin even entered the world, God created us for work. That's why we were created. God told Adam in what's known as the cultural mandate back in Genesis chapter 2 to cultivate the garden and care for this world. And so if you remember, he actually established him as a vice regent over his creation, which of course extends to you and me. And so we were actually created to cultivate and carry out the image of our Creator in us, in our own creations and work. And so to refuse to work and instead leech is actually to kick against the very goads of God's purpose and design for your life. And so all Solomon is trying to do here in context is simply say that if you think a proper response to a world full of rivalry is just to kick back and do nothing, well, you're deceiving yourself. Nature itself declares you're a fool. And so what he does in verse 6 then is respond with a balanced perspective. Look at what he says. He states, "One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind." So he just said in verse 5, don't be a fool who refuses to do anything. But on the other hand, last part of verse 6, don't be equally foolish and spend all your effort, time, and energy pursuing everything. Both extremes are an exercise of futility. And so actually what he's saying here is that the key to enjoying life, which is a gift from God, is to have a balanced approach, or to use his language, a better approach, where you spend your days pursuing not only labor, but equally importantly, rest. So remember from chapter 2 that labor is indeed a gift from God. And so you ought to have joy. You ought to find delight in the labor of your hands as you carry out the image of your Creator in you. But just do not forget that labor and the fruit of your labor at the end of the day is fleeting. Which is actually why he concludes by saying that two fists full of labor is nothing more than striving after the wind. Not only will labor and stuff not satisfy the cravings of a jealous heart, but it will keep you chasing after that which is unattainable. And so Solomon, in the simple wisdom that he offers here, is saying, look, if you want to be a person that's not driven or controlled by trying to outdo your neighbor, at the very least earn their respect, learn to rest. Learn to work hard at your job, but come home and rest well. Watch a movie. Play with your children. Eat a good meal. I think what probably might be hard about this, at least for some Christians, is that it sounds so unspiritual, doesn't it? It sounds like it's something that the unbelieving world does, or perhaps already does. But if you can learn to see life, all of life, as spiritual, as worship, and then understand that the exercise of God's wisdom as it's communicated through Solomon is worship, then I think you'll begin to discover that there's something glorious and rewarding and joyful about heeding this wisdom of Solomon. That a balanced approach to rest and labor will not only free you from the anxiety that so often accompanies the pursuit of more, but will also be a kind of balanced approach to life that honors God and pleases God, because it's the kind of life he intended for his creation to have. Part of the havel that's built into this world is this thing called envy. And all of it is oozing from our hearts. All of us have it. It motivates us. It compels us. Indeed, it controls us. And so if you live a life blinded to this reality, the promise of Solomon is not only will you never find contentment, but it'll rob you of the joy and satisfaction that God's intended for you to have in the details of life. So whatever hobbies or skills that you might have, just resolve now that there'll always be somebody better. There just will. There'll always be somebody smarter. There'll always be somebody richer. There'll always be someone more gifted and skilled. But the secret to joy is to view your labor and your skills as a gift of God. That's huge in Ecclesiastes. And so whatever you have from him. Enjoy them, work hard at them, but then go home, give thanks, and rest. That's wisdom, and according to Solomon, worshipful living. And so Solomon says, one handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. Next, verse 7, he states, then I looked again, so another observation here. I looked again at the vanity or havel under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is havel, and it is a grievous, or literally evil, task. So in these couple of verses, we're introduced to another theme, namely the havel of loneliness. And let me just state up front that this idea of loneliness here isn't speaking of all loneliness or every instance of loneliness, but rather it's a commentary on the reason behind why certain kinds of people are lonely. Notice, he said it's a kind of person without a dependent. And the idea here is it's one who's willfully chosen to be alone. He's made the active decision not to pursue a wife or children, but instead wealth. Quite simply, it's the quintessential miser. That is, the person who hoards their wealth and never spends. In fact, not only do they not have a spouse or children, but they're also described as not even having a brother or, more generically, a relative. And the idea here is most likely speaking of the fact that this person either shunned or, more likely drove off any kind of family. They run as fast and as far away as possible. One man states, this is, without a doubt, the description of the self-absorbed, self-centered workaholic that no one wants to be around. This is the kind of person who's so motivated to acquire wealth or to make a name for himself or to keep the theme of Ecclesiastes, to lay hold of gain, that he actually has no time for anything but labor. In fact, Solomon phrases it here as there is no end to all his labor. He doesn't even have a certain amount in his mind that he thinks would make him happy. And so notice the reason for this, middle of verse 8. He states his eyes were not satisfied with riches. Well, that's obvious. And he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? In other words, this person is so busy, that is so consumed with acquiring his wealth, that he's never even taken the time to stop long enough to consider why. For what purpose am I making myself weary? Doug Wilson comments, a man works hard to make a pile and doesn't stop to ask a very basic question. Why am I doing this? He makes a stack of money but has no one to share it with. He can't afford to marry or have children because they would take him away from his work. He can't afford to have friends because all their motives would be suspect. He could buy dinner for everyone in the restaurant, but no one wants to sit with him. But that's all right because he doesn't want to sit with them either. And so what I think is interesting about this little parable here is that it's the first time in Ecclesiastes that we see Havel, but it's a kind of self-inflicted Havel. It's the kind of Havel that's derived from having a skewed perspective about life and for what and how we were created. Quite simply, it's the self-inflicted affirmation of God when he said back in Genesis, it is not good for man to be alone. Perhaps there are some of you in this room this morning who are so preoccupied with your goals, with your ambitions, with trying to make a name for yourself and acquire for yourself that you've never actually stopped to ask the simple question of why? For what purpose? Notice, the man in this parable never asks, for whom am I laboring in depriving myself of pleasure? Quite literally, it could be rendered, for whom am I laboring in depriving my soul of a good thing? And what's interesting here is that the way this thing is constructed in the grammar, what's implied here is that the good thing or pleasure that's brought to a person's soul isn't so much the enjoyment of the fruit of their labor, but actually the enjoyment that comes from sharing the fruit of their labor. There's something that happens in the soul, in the way that God's designed us, when we share the fruit of our labors with others. And especially when the people with whom you share, you have a deep, abiding relationship. There's simply a design in this, and it is a good thing. One man comments, the point here is that companionship is dear. God created us for friendship, and a curse resides on all things which prevent men from forming friendships. And one of the great culprits in this affair is the task of making big-time money. And so the counsel of Solomon here is, do not be so blind. It is far better and far more pleasurable to the soul to have little but share than to have much and be alone. There's simply a havel to loneliness, indeed evil, to use the language of Solomon, when loneliness results from the pursuit of more. Now, verses 9 through 12, and here he just sort of expands on this idea of companionship. And so here he gives just some generic reasons for why companionship is just a better way than loneliness. And he uses the idea of travel in the ancient world, which would have been very dangerous, especially if you were alone, to sort of illustrate the point. So starting in verse 9, he writes, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. But furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. So let me just quickly say here that on an initial read, these four verses might just sort of sound like four almost random proverbs, just kind of strung together where they're all just sort of saying the same thing. But what we actually have here is a little mini narrative taking place. And there's not a lot of detail or really background. And so the reader's actually expected to sort of fill in the gaps. And the reason for that is so that it would have been much easier to remember the point. So let's just quickly walk through this. So starting in verse 9, notice the illustration begins with this language of profit or return and labor. And so what he's actually setting up here is a picture of two business partners. He states two are better than one because they have a good return or profit from their labor. So quite simply, they're laboring over their work. And since there's two of them here, there's more product being created and therefore more product being sold. There's simply more profit to be had. And then moving into verse 10, we see the two companions now hitting the road. And here's where you have to sort of fill in the gaps. It's likely that they're traveling together to perhaps deliver their product from verse 9. And so the idea of falling here would have been something incredibly devastating in the ancient world. And due to that term woe there in the middle of verse 10, perhaps even fatal. And so without trying to read too much into these verses, the point is simply that traveling alone was unwise, and therefore two are better than one. Then in verse 11, we have the two lying down together to keep warm. And this one doesn't carry any kind of sexual connotation, but it's actually a reference to the fact that it becomes very cold at night while on the road. And so, as you know, one of the techniques to staying warm is just to sort of bundle up together to keep in the heat. And so the point here is that clearly two are better than one. And so then in verse 12, we have the two companions defending themselves, or perhaps even their product, from thieves. And so the idea here is that if you're all alone, you don't really stand a chance. But if you have two, or better yet, three, you're much better off. And so without quibbling too much over the details of these verses, all he's doing here with this little narrative is really just trying to give a metaphor for life. Quite simply, the message of Solomon is that no matter who you are or what you have, companionship is always better. And it's not limited here to things just like marriage or family, but also includes the idea of true, genuine friendship. In fact, the Proverbs speak much of the value of friendship. So much so that a true friend is actually described as being better than even family. For instance, really quick, in Proverbs 17:17, the author writes, "A friend loves at all times, but a brother whose family is born for adversity." Or Proverbs 18:24, "A man of many friends comes to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than even a brother." And so the idea of friendship, that is true friendship, proverbial friendship, is incredibly important for life. And so all of this just speaks to the idea that companionship is better than loneliness. That's the point of Solomon. And since the theme here is this idea of balance, let me just conclude this section here by drawing your attention to this language of better. So we've already seen that loneliness is havel, and that it's an interesting form of havel because it's the first time we see a kind of self-inflicted havel. And so what's interesting about this is that since it's a form of self-inflicted havel, what also comes with it then is a remedy, which of course is this idea of companionship. But the thing I want you to notice here is that Solomon never says relationships solve the problem of loneliness. He simply states it's better than loneliness, which is a really important distinction. What we must remember is that since all things under the sun are subjected to havel, even those things for which Solomon has labeled as better still carry with them havel. And so the wisdom of Solomon here is to have a balanced perspective. That is, do not so lift up people, that is, relationships, whether it be friends or family or even your spouse, that when they fail you, because they will, they're sinners, you're left empty, broken, and alone. But on the other hand, and equally importantly, do not so reject people that you retreat into loneliness and find yourself depleted, bitter, and self-justifying in your grievances against humanity. And so the truth of this passage is that there's just a design to life. God created us for community. And so the point is that relationships are better than loneliness. For as one commentator sums this up, man is built by God for community. And so loneliness is a great evil, for it spits in the face of God's good design. Well, this then leads into the final observation of Havel in chapter 4, and it's found here in verses 13 through 16. And here we have another four-verse narrative, and while the immediate context is a political scene, the underlying principle extends beyond politics. It's much more broad. So verse 13, Solomon writes, "A poor yet wise lad is better," there it is again, "than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction." So he basically just starts out here by saying that there's these people in life, And for some reason or another, in God's sovereignty and providence, they're gifted and intelligent and just find themselves being placed into positions of immense authority where they have incredible power and influence. But however long that may last, it seems like no matter who they are or what they do, maybe you've met the person, eventually a day comes when they've been doing what they've been doing long enough, usually energized or really even just arrogant because of past successes, come to a point where they no longer know how to receive instruction. And so Solomon says, a poor yet wise youth, who not only knows how to recognize wisdom, but then also knows how to receive wisdom and then act and make decisions in accordance to that wisdom, is better than an old, foolish, even though experienced king. Well, obviously, the definition of a fool here is one who no longer knows how to receive instruction. They've got it all sort of figured out. And so he goes on here in verse 14, talking about the young, wiser man. He writes, for he, the young man, has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his, that is the older king's kingdom. So here we see the young man coming out of prison, perhaps because he was so poor he couldn't pay down debts. And so he serves his time and comes out to replace the old, foolish king. And the reason for this replacement is because there's something about wisdom that's attractive. Remembering that wisdom here is the ability to receive instruction. And so the fact that this young man was poor perhaps gave him some insights that the older king didn't have. He was poor. He was in prison. He wasn't able to meet the demands of government. And so he comes out of prison and we see him winning the favor of the people. He resonates with them. And we see that here in verse 15. Solomon writes, I have seen all the living under the sun, that's all the people of the kingdom, throng to the side of the second lad, the young one, who replaces him, that is the king. And so now, here we see the people of the kingdom flocking toward the young man. There's excitement. He makes sense. Maybe he's got a vision. He receives instruction. And so it takes really no time at all to win the favor of the people. There's just something better about someone who receives wisdom. And so the simple lesson of Solomon here is that it's a good thing, indeed a better thing, to be a person who heeds counsel. It's always a wise person who surrounds himself with many counselors, as it says in Proverbs 15, and then listens with an intention to actually apply that wisdom. And so the point here is that there's this thing about old age and experience, according to Solomon, that sometimes has this way of actually hardening the person, of causing them to become kind of stiff-necked. And so the simple counsel of Solomon here is, do not be such a person. Rather, be a person who's in the consistent state of always learning, of always surrounding yourself with counsel and instruction for life. For that is far better. Such an important lesson, especially for those in leadership who think they're infinitely wise. But then look at what he does. I like what he does here at the end. Just in case the young man decides to get cocky. Lest you think the pursuit and exercise of wisdom will forever secure your position, look at what he says here in verse 16. He writes, there is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him. Talking now about the young man. For this too is vanity in striving after the wind. So the pronouns make this a little bit confusing here, but basically what he's saying is that no matter how much you surround yourself with wise counsel, no matter how much you might pursue wisdom, no matter how much favor you have with people, eventually a day is coming in which somebody's going to get unhappy, and when that day comes, you'll be replaced just as fast as you were put into power. And so Solomon says, as we saw back in chapter 2, never forget that wisdom is no guarantee. So what's Solomon's word to us this morning? How do we bring this all together? Well, it's an interesting passage, and to be honest, a difficult one. Because as we've seen, it just kind of jumps from one observation to another with no real satisfying conclusion. He really just makes a series of observations here in this text. But if I had to sum it all up, I think we could summarize this text because of this little word better here, the repetition of the word better, with this idea of balance. I think the wisdom of Solomon here is very boring, but at the same time, very simple and profound. Quite simply, the point of this text is to pursue the balanced life. And as boring as that may seem, I think the idea of balance has more to do with worship than we think. So Solomon's observation here about how you and I do everything from rivalry, that is jealousy, well, that's a worship issue. The fact that people plow themselves into loneliness due to their overwork, pushing away friends, family, and rejecting all that's to be found in God's good design of relationships, that's a worship issue. The fact that those in power become conceited and arrogant, rejecting all counsel, that's a worship issue. And so the simple counsel of Solomon here, and really the underlying theme of this passage, is that to pursue a balanced life is to pursue a life that pleases God. And the reason for that is because you're no longer looking to the extremes as the answer to life. You're no longer pursuing everything to the extreme to find purpose and meaning or that thing which you think will give you ultimate happiness or rest. And so in the enigmatic way that only Solomon could do, and all he's really trying to communicate is to have a proper perspective of life. That's it. Balance your alone time with relationships. Balance your experience with counsel. Balance your labor with rest. Because as a man who not only pursued, but as we saw in chapter 2, also attained every form of extreme, Solomon's simple conclusion when all is said and done is that true contentment, true happiness is not found in the pursuit and attainment of the extremes, but in the balance of life. I think that at the end of the day, Solomon's simple wisdom, and therefore God's wisdom to us, of pursuing the balanced life is the kind of wisdom that sustains. What we must remember, and the drum that he's been beating really since the end of chapter 2, is that this life which you and I live, whether you're a believer or not, is nothing short of a gift of God. But there's these things in life, this posture toward life that not only makes it unpleasant, but also robs you from the kind of joy God intended for you to have. And so as one man concludes on this text, he writes, "Don't let the havel, or I would say the pursuit of the extremes, resulting in greed, envy, loneliness, politics, or power, pull you away from the true gifts of God." So pursue these gifts, but pursue them with balance. And so my final word to us this morning is that as we live out this gift called life, my hope and my prayer for us this morning, and really what I've been praying all throughout these sermons on Ecclesiastes, is that we no longer spend our days pursuing the wind. And that instead we might be able to find lasting satisfaction in God alone, and that in Him we not only find contentment, but also come to a place where we can say with the fullness of our minds that He is our hope, He is enough, and therefore our sustaining joy.